Good morning. My name's Joe Bandel. Welcome to Deadly Days, Tales of Dark Fantasy. This is going to be episode 23, so we're stacking up those stories. I hope that you enjoy them and are telling other people about them so it can kind of spread a little bit. Anyway, I translate these stories from the German, and I have a couple favorite authors that you're going to find. One is Karl Hans Strobel, and the other is Hans Heinz Ewers. Otherwise, the stories are taken from Der Orchideen Garden, which is the world's first fantasy magazine, illustrated fantasy magazine, which came out in German in 1919, and I'm translating those. And the last one is a magazine called Cocaine, which there were a few issues that came out. I translated them for Side Reel Press, and I'm throwing stories in. Today's story is coming from the Cocaine magazine. It's called Love. It's by Fritz Bauer. Now, it's a fairly long story, so I'm not going to talk too long, but if you're interested in stories like these, I have published them as short stories, and there are novels as well, more coming. You can find them on lulu.com, L-U-L-U.com. And you can go there and you can look up under my name, Joe Bandel, band like a rock and roll band, E-L, or by the authors, or however the titles, if you were able to do that. Otherwise, go to my webpage that, well, it's on there. lulu.com/spotlight/anarchistbanjo. Now, other authors that I've translated, Stanislaw Przybyszewski and Paul Besson. I'm very interested in Paul Besson currently. I've just put out a novel by him called Fire on the Glacier, which to me is one of the best stories that I have ever read in my life. I feel very fortunate to be able to put my own translation out there. So anyway, like, subscribe. Like I said, feel free to spread the word around. These are just stories, and they're good stories, but it's kind of like you either like them or you don't like them. If you do like them, you're in good company. So anyway, I better get going. This is, like I said, this is a longer story. Love by Fritz Bauer. Greetings, Mary, my sweet little girl. So nice that things are working out for you. Now listen. 9:45 this evening, our express leaves. Make your preparations. But take your time. There is plenty of time. Meanwhile, there is also time to smash your porous worldview and build a new one. It was Robert Lehndorf who greeted Mary in this way. Lehndorf was the editor of a large daily newspaper. He had only gradually risen in his profession through great effort. This was not based upon his abilities, but due to the jealousies and circumstances surrounding him, as well as the bad will of those around him. It was not until recently that a change in ownership also brought a remedy regarding the editorial department, in which he managed to develop his talent and greatly increase the sphere of influence of the newspaper itself. Today, at the age of 38, he was a journalistic figure to be reckoned with in the public sector. He met Mary when she came to his editorial office one day to oppose and protest an outrageous criticism of a newly published book. Robert was blinded by Mary's overwhelming grace, her youth, and natural charm. He did not listen at all to her accurate objections, but was charmed by her spirit and only responded to her sparkling words. In this way, a witty, satirical banter developed, and Mary was so engaging that her visit went beyond its original purpose. It was an excessively long visit, and at its closing, albeit with a fearful heart, she agreed to a meeting with him that evening. These two people were both strong individuals with firm lifestyles and clear-cut goals. They seemed to have been created for one another for some higher purpose, and their fate was fulfilled that same evening. They had met every day since then, but the fact that Mary was married cast a shadow over their otherwise tranquil lives. Marriage offered her all conceivable material comforts, but nothing required by her powerful spirituality and her exceptional personality. So her marriage was a single shadow in her otherwise sunny relationship with Robert. It is what caused so much dissonance. All too often, they were not allowed to be seen together in public. That is why their meeting for today had been moved to a distant location far from the center of the city. It was Mary herself who had thought about this almost every day and had proposed it. Now, since Robert was suddenly in agreement, she was embarrassed, hesitant, and undecided. Yes, good. But what will I tell my husband? But dear Mary, I thought you were already in agreement with him. At least yesterday you told me Albert recognized the need for your little outings and agreed to them without further ado. That's right, Mary replied. But, you know, dear Robert, I have this feeling of restlessness, apprehension about this abuse of his trust. And if I really think about it, how in doing this I belittle Albert and am acting foolishly. Robert, who was often in a position of needing to plead with her not to spoil every hour of their get-together, with fearful and in his opinion, exaggerated concern for her husband, was not pleased and became embittered. I do not fail to understand your situation, dear Mary, he said dryly. Yet I must confess that I find it extremely strange that your conscience is so burdened just when I have agreed to your long-expressed desires. If I delayed in agreeing to our travel plan until today, it was out of consideration of him no less than yourself. Just that, and the worry of finding an appropriate form for my book to get it ready for the publisher probably influenced me as well on the timing, but I never tried to prevent the goal itself. Mary, who was well acquainted with Robert's moods, now feared that he would fall into a depressed state and tried to calm him down. But he continued as before. I now see you in tears in front of me, in excruciating concern over your husband. Please, don't hold it against me if I refrain from embracing a woman whose senses long for another. And moreover, I see in your behavior a confirmation of my old suspicions. Robert, cried Mary in dismay, you are out of your mind. How can you speak to me that way? You know that Albert means nothing to me, not him or anyone else in the world, only you. Robert, whose heaviness was beginning to master him, didn't allow Mary to finish and said, You agree, dear Mary, that I do not take your exultation seriously and listen to your words with my usual restraint. My suspicion, which has always existed, is that you are torn between two men, and after today you will hardly be able to deny it. Mary, who had thought of everything else, had not expected this outburst from Robert, and was deeply dismayed by this very unexpected and unwanted argument. Tears came to her eyes, and in her helplessness, as well as trying to calm him down, she cried hastily, I'm going. I'm leaving right now, Albert. without saying a word or goodbye to Albert. He will be completely in the dark, think that I fled, became lost, am dead. It's too late, Mary, replied Robert, who was already regretting his moodiness. The train just left the station. Now go home. Perhaps we can go tomorrow. Are you still angry? Asked Mary, partly reassured, seeing that Robert was calming down. Not at all, Mary. I am as much yours as I was yesterday and tomorrow and will be every day. Now good night. Good night, my darling. Mary blew him a kiss and quickly left, still upset and trembling from the intensity of what they had just been through. She had hardly taken a few steps when she heard someone behind her say, May I kiss your hand, madam? How irresponsible of your husband to leave you alone at this hour. If you permit, I would be happy to drive you home. Oh, it is you, doctor, cried Mary as she recognized Dr. Sharp, an acquaintance of her husband's. You gave me a fright. Thank you. I don't want to be a bother. I will go by myself. Please don't think badly of me if I insist on remaining at your side. You seem to be upset, trembling, have tears in your eyes. Is Mr. Lehndorf responsible for your condition? I have noticed before how he is often brusque with you. The fool, he is supposed to be the genius of this epoch, while in reality his talent is to tyrannize women and other weaklings. Mary trembled at the thought that Dr. Sharp might have overheard her conversation with Robert. But she forced herself to remain calm and said, You speak very poorly of Mr. Lehndorf. And changing the subject, she asked, But what brings you to this neighborhood, which has nothing of interest for you and offers very little in the way of a pleasant stroll? Dr. Sharp hesitated a moment and then replied, Please relieve me, gracious madam, of the duty of truthfully answering your question, as it would be a little embarrassing for both of us. I can't think of anything in our present situation that would be embarrassing to either one of us, Mary said with a smile. Yet my question was a bit out of line, and I apologize for asking it. Now I do ask you to stop accompanying me, as I am in a hurry and will take a cab. Forgive me, madam, if I must insist, and I must insist due to the position I have been given concerning you, replied Dr. Sharp in a tone of deepest regret. I understand the disagreeable nature of my task and ask you to consider how difficult it is for me to combine my duty toward my friend and consideration toward his wife. You are wrong, cried Mary, dismayed. I don't understand what you are talking about. What does your friend have to do with me, and who is your friend? What are your orders, and who gave them to you? Your husband, replied Dr. Sharp, slowly and with a strong emphasis. Mary was seized by a terrible premonition. In a flash, she made the connection between her husband's possible suspicions and this encounter with Dr. Sharp, who had been watching her, eavesdropping, and who now knew everything and would tell her husband. My fear, she groaned, scarcely audible, my constant fear of getting found out. She swayed and reached out in vain for some support. Dr. Sharp reached for her arm and tucked it into his. She moved forward automatically, unable to organize her feelings and see the situation clearly. Thousands of thoughts rushed upon her, then broke apart after a few seconds, and rushed away, only to come back again, combined into one overwhelming emotion. To have fallen from radiant heights to being plunged into infinitely dirty depths. the sheer endless battle that she had fought all her life against the inherited poverty and petty conventional bourgeois of her parents' home had all been for nothing. Lack and deprivation had dogged her relentlessly throughout her entire childhood. The prosperity that she saw outside her circle inspired her passionate pursuit for personal development in a type of despair from which she was only able to free herself by virtue of her intelligence, which was far above the average. Aside from that, her sense of self-worth, her aesthetically balanced sense of contradiction, and her surrender to the fate of an ordinary life gave her a certain charm. In such life situations, her graceful, slender shape, her attractive and captivating appearance, and her general likable nature only acted to strengthen the others. However, there was no lack of serious appreciation of her individuality. Her heart alone, which sang out for a true relationship, had an influence on her respective opinions in decisive ways. When she turned 26, the restrictions of her parents' home became more unbearable from day to day. That was when she saw her belief in herself began to weaken. And in relation to that, her own inner strength began to waver as well. At this time of extreme need, and just before her moral collapse, she became Albert Rayner's wife. His position as a well-to-do industrialist enabled him to establish a comfortable home and to provide a household with plenty of money. However, Mary was moderate in her demands and arranged their life in a modest way. Albert Rayner, 40 years old, clung to his wife with enthusiastic affection. In a feeling of grateful gratitude, she subordinated herself to his person and his interests, always tactfully avoiding ways in which he might become aware of her superior intellect. She knew Robert Lehndorf from before, from his journalistic work, which had always had a powerful effect on her. When she confronted him soon after her marriage, she felt the attractive force that emanated from him as a debilitating influence on her person and her ability to concentrate. She gave herself to him without thought, and the love which the two people built up was of a rare passion, an incomparable glow of two souls in harmony. After the secret hours of almost narcotic pleasure, she went home, tormented by a consuming remorse. In such a condition of repressed guilt, she offered her husband even more feminine tenderness, whether to compensate for her breach of trust or to hide from him all kinds of indiscretions. When she tried to tell Robert about her martyrdom, he didn't agree with her at all and made her life even more turbulent by repeatedly accusing her of being in love with two men and not wanting to let either of them go. Yet, her repeated calm and clear sharing of the thousands of embarrassments to which she was exposed every day as a result of the current situation helped him to temporarily accept the hopelessness of the situation. But even after unpleasant confrontations of this kind, the indignation on both sides soon gave way and a more conciliatory mood returned, and their love was celebrated. The sacredness of their love was celebrated. Now her relationship with Robert had been discovered. This secret, which had weighed upon her like a nightmare, which had been a constant fear and worry, and which she had hidden from her husband with constant and agonizing hypocrisy, was now revealed. The shame of it pushed her into the ground. Dr. Sharp suddenly broke the silence and said, "Your husband entrusted me with this task tonight. He has long suspected that you were unfaithful to him, so he made a friendly request that I follow you and inform him of what was going on. Since I have always known of your relationship with Robert Lehndorf, I could have given him the information on the spot. But instead, convinced your husband that I knew nothing in particular. I was reluctant to make accusations that would have disastrous consequences for you, madam, although I consider it unworthy to use this opportunity to mention my own sympathies, which I have for you, Mary. They are the real reason that I have forgotten my duty to my friend, your husband. With growing horror, Mary heard the words of her companion. Yet she pretended to be overcome by a feeling of gratitude and said, I am wholeheartedly indebted to you for your discretion, doctor. Yet in the same moment she became clear about the significance of her words, which were equivalent to an admission. She saw the abyss in front of her, into which she had been pushed through the suddenness of this entire situation, and tried to save herself by taking a leap backwards. She took on a note of pride and irony and added to her earlier reply, There is no need for me to react to your bold remarks, but I deny that Mr. Lehndorf is to be seen in any other way than a purely platonic friendship that is the result of our common literary interests. That you presume to be a friend of my husband is tasteless enough of you, but to claim his trust and to be carrying out some silly request is an outrage for which you should be disciplined. You're a bad comedian, Mary, said Dr. Sharp cynically. Really, the zeal with which you maintain such a hopeless cause reveals just how much you have to hide. I overheard your sortie. I don't consider traveling together with Lehndorf to be a literary matter, that and what can only be regarded as such a tender kiss. Mary felt she was being hit by these words. She lost her earlier composure completely, and each word that Dr. Sharp continued to say showed her the hopelessness of her situation. An escape such as you were prepared to make, continued Dr. Sharp, with biting mockery, is perhaps romantic, but certainly not literary. It may be an urgent need for your heart, but it means an unheard-of cruelty towards your husband, humiliation, deviousness. Oh, be quiet, spare me. What should I do? Cried Mary in despair. Reconcile with me, and everything will be fine. So please, said Mary intently, forgive me for my harsh words from earlier. If you are seriously asking for my forgiveness, please prove it to me. Kiss me. Oh, God, Mary moaned. The time is very advanced, Mary. It is getting late and your husband is waiting for you. The black clouds announce a heavy thunderstorm. Permit me to get my car and take you home. They had hardly climbed into the coupe when Dr. Sharp kissed her on the mouth, brutally, greedily. Now we are even, but now you need to remain silent. Don't give me away. Mary tried unsuccessfully to free herself from his embrace. Let me go, she cried in horror. Let me go. Help. I love you, Mary. Think about what is at stake. I will remain silent, not say a single word. Let go of me, screamed Mary. You are a monster. If you do tell, the shame, the despair. I won't speak a word. On the contrary, I say, it is the only way out for you. I will save you. I love you. Mary fainted and lost consciousness. She came back to her senses just as the car stopped with a slight jerk in front of her villa. Her husband heard the horn, suspected that Mary had arrived, and hurried down the stairs. But Mary, he said half reproachfully, half worried, it's almost midnight. Has something happened? You look so distraught. He took her by the arm and led her into the living room, where she sat down in an armchair. He sat down across from her. "Nothing is wrong, dear Albert," replied Mary, trying to maintain her composure. "Just a small accident, of all things. Remember the crossroads on the Beltway? The tram suddenly appeared and brushed my car. Nothing else happened, just the fright of it." "Yes, but what about the entire time before that, dear Mary? I did not think you had anything planned for the evening. Bringing the money to Rosner could have only taken a few minutes. I was only concerned about the large sum of money. I feel very bad that this happened to you, especially tonight. Do you know, Mary, why this evening is so important to me?" "Yes, Albert, I know. Today, it's been a year since we got married." "Oh, thank you, my dear Mary, for remembering. Time and time again, it makes me happy to realize that you are thinking of things and activities that we can share, whether in the past or in the future. From this, I think I can see that you two are happy." Mary thought she heard mockery and irony in her husband's sympathetic and kind words. His ambiguous, catchy way of speaking cut deep into her heart, and she felt the urge to jump up and confront him about the reprehensibility of his suspicions, especially that he could use Dr. Sharp in such a calculating way. But the horror of what had happened paralyzed her energy, shattered her concentration, and confused her thoughts. When Mary did not respond, Albert continued in a soft voice. "Today, 1 year ago, almost exactly at this time and in this room, you stood in front of me in radiant beauty, shy, embarrassed, poignantly unself-conscious, and asked me to go with you for a walk. I laughed at your foolish idea, brushed it off, but you persisted. So we went and arrived at the train station an hour before its departure. You filled the time chatting about Wedekind and Strindberg. I disagreed with your views, but today I admit to you, I didn't have the slightest idea of who either one of them was. They could have been seafarers, explorers of the North Pole, or the like. You, on the other hand, ha ha ha, took my replies and argued with me as if it were a matter of life and death. Ha ha ha, ha, let us toast, my child, that you can always be so happy, and you and your Strindberg and your Wedekind. But you are so serious and not happy at all. That is too bad. Let us talk about something else. What did the Rosners have to say? They were probably quite happy to have you back into their own hands, 9/10 of the money that they had lost. They were probably happy to have back into their own hands 9/10 of the money that they had lost. Did you get a receipt?
No, Albert. I have not delivered the money yet. It is in my purse. On the way there, I met an acquaintance, and our conversation stretched out too long without my realizing it. And then, I didn't get around to it.
That was not right of you, Mary. These people have been scared for so long, and I promised them the money today. Please go first thing in the morning. No. Give me the money and I will take care of it some other way. Mary went to her dressing room where she had laid down her purse earlier, opened it, and discovered it was empty. She felt paralyzed with terror. She searched through her things, feverishly, countless times. Empty. The packet of money was not there, and neither was the letter from Robert. A shiver ran through her body, and she nearly fainted. How could she explain that to her husband? She did not have the strength to do it, and not today. Then a thought occurred to her. She hurried to the phone, got connected to Rosner, and pretended that he himself had called. Oh, yes,
It is me, Mr. Rosner. My husband is here, yes. Albert, Albert. But please, may I speak with you myself, Mr. Rosner? The money is here. It was just a mix-up. Tomorrow, I will bring it myself. Yes, myself. Nothing worth talking about. Good night. Greetings from my husband. She sat down quickly on the nearest chair. You see, Mary, how worried they were. Now, since you have promised, go there yourself. Albert, did you send the maid away? Mary asked. Yes, she accompanied your friend Magda, who waited for you until just before you came home. Magda was upset that your adventures lasted so late into the night. Jokingly, of course. Magda is not my friend, exclaimed Mary. Rather the opposite. I don't like her. She just makes it seem as if we are. My thoughts exactly, replied Albert. Her independent, unladylike manner makes Magda less than pleasant. This entire evening she went on about a Mr. Lehndorf and greatly abused my patience. Are these supposed to be innuendos, Albert? I don't understand you, my child. These are not illusions but facts, which upset me badly. I was glad when Dr. Sharp came. Unfortunately, he soon had to leave the house on an important mission. Otherwise, Albert, what is wrong with you, Mary? You are trembling and pale. Have a sip of this liquor. That is better. I have never seen you like this, Mary. You have had a bad evening today. Mary forced herself to be calm and in a most ingenuous tone asked, why was Dr. Sharp here? Is your relation with him so intimate that you trust him with important business? What are you thinking, Mary? Dr. Sharp, whom I have repeatedly lent money to, came back today and tried to get a relatively high sum from me. I refused him, especially since this morning, after my lawyer told me what a brutal and unprincipled person he was. Mary listened greedily to her husband's words, and the more he spoke, the more she realized that she had become the victim of her own fate, whom the unscrupulous scoundrel had taken advantage of. Albert continued with his report. He drinks and has wasted his own money as well as that of strangers, and is naturally not willing to make good on his reckless investments. I will make certain that he never enters our house again. It was a good thing that Magda sent him away on some mysterious mission. Mary could no longer withstand these damning revelations. They churned in her deepest core and caused her to collapse. Even her, who had always been able to maintain her composure, even in the most desperate of circumstances, her spirited nature, which was so delicately balanced, had always been able to stand up for a cause, been able to consider each pro and con with clear understanding. Now it seemed as if she had fallen from her lofty, unattainable high standard, and she was now rolling in the gutter along the curb, and everyone had a right to consider her disgraced. All these heavy attacks on Mary's nature pressed forcefully for release and triggered a violent sobbing in her, which soon turned into a mild, steady stream of tears, and the hottest pain was washed away. Albert, in his natural sensitivity, did not push for an explanation of this unusual incident. He loved his wife, was totally devoted to her, and held neither doubt nor suspicion. He moved over to her, softly embraced her in his arms, and comforted her with kind, loving words. She only resisted weakly against his ardent desires, and finally fell into his passionate embrace. The next morning, Mary awoke with dull feelings and unclear, confused thoughts. The events of the past evening occupied her thoughts to such a degree that she felt incapable of any action, of any precise, logically structured course of action that would see her through this situation. She swerved from one thought to another, overlooking the most probable and clinging to the most remote, most improbable. In an increasing passionate desire to escape from reality to that place where all things come true, where they regain their former balanced nature, their moral purity in a moral and consolidated worldview, where she could erase the stigma of what had happened, could forget, could rest. But the harshness of necessity, the burdens of the moment, forced her to pull herself together and act. She sat down and wrote, "Dear Mr. Rosner, at the last moment, circumstances have suddenly forced me to ask you to be patient for just a few days. I must have suddenly misplaced or even lost the money that my husband gave me last night. I cannot find it and need to get it again, a process that will take a few days. I do not have the courage to share this loss with my husband, and it lies especially in my heart that he should not know of this further inconvenience to you, dear Mr. Rosner. But it would be of greatest reassurance to me. I trust in your proven friendship, and you can rely on mine. I expect that if my husband asks about it, you will take a position appropriate to the situation." She sent the letter by messenger. After that, she prepared to go out. She was scarcely finished dressing when the maid brought her a letter in which only a few lines were written. "I ask you, dear Mary, in the interest of your reputation, to visit me immediately. Yours, Magda." Mary took her car and a few moments later found herself sitting across from Magda. "It is not fear for my reputation that brought me here so quickly, Magda," she said calmly. "I don't think that has been endangered in any way. I was intending to visit you anyway, and it was only by accident that I received your letter before I left. I have a request for you." "But my dear," replied Magda, and irritated by Mary's calm demeanor, "you certainly have no idea of the scope of what now threatens you. But first to your concern, which has actually made me worthy of the honor of your visit. How, my dear, may I be of service?" Mary pretended to ignore the ironic tone and said, but not without an inner anxiety, "I wanted to ask you, Magda, to help me, if you would be so kind, because you have plenty of resources at your disposal, to help me out of a momentary embarrassment." "Ah, you need money," Magda exclaimed, surprised and interested. "How is that even conceivable? Your husband alone. How much do you need?" 10,000 gold crowns." "Ah, that is strange. Where to even begin, dear Mary? You know, yesterday it would have been possible for me, but in the meantime, I have committed myself to a talented person to whom I loaned a lot, a very significant amount." "Then don't bother, Magda," Mary interrupted. "It is far from me to cause you any inconvenience. Please don't be angry with me. Farewell, then." "But, Mary, you forget what is currently much more important than your need for money. It's actually weird, this coincidence of circumstances. Yesterday it was late at night, actually closer to dawn. Dr. Sharp stormed to my house door and demanded that he be allowed in under any circumstances. You should see me when I first wake up. He entered my bedroom in an unspeakable condition, declared that he had gambled a horrible amount in roulette and demanded compensation from me. I thought he was drunk and waved him out. But now comes the incomprehensible. He seriously claimed to have evidence in hand that would heavily compromise you, make it impossible for you to live as a married woman. Entirely impossible. Now listen to this. He wanted to sell this evidence and turn to me as your most intimate friend. Mary, shaken by horror, kept her composure on the outside and asked lightly, "I don't care for this talk of a blackmailer, but what were his proofs and what price did he demand for them?" "Exactly the same amount that you wanted from me, and the same amount that he lost gambling. Isn't it strange that these sums match?" "You know, I was really interested in the matter, and I thought, if he is being truthful about one thing, he might also be about the other, and therefore I should take his talk of slander more seriously. Therefore, I rang the gambling hall, where they confirmed his loss. Then I asked you to come here immediately, so I could warn you." "Please, Magda, you avoided my earlier question. What kind of evidence was it? What does he intend to do to enforce his blackmail?" "I am pleased, dear Mary, that your interest in this matter is increasing," replied Magda with clear irony. "Evidence. It is a tender letter addressed to you, dear Mary, and for the time being he intends to support his demands with small prickling revelations. If, by the way, you are interested in his latest project, you can meet him here this evening. If you tried one more time..." "No, no," Mary fiercely resisted. "I am not the least bit interested in what you suggest. Now I am leaving." She turned toward the exit, as Magda blocked her way and said in a biting tone, "Now I must reproach you, dear Mary, for being so careless in your adventures. You should have paid more attention to your own position and not compromised mine as well." Mary forcefully exited through the door and, without a specific goal in mind, rushed through the nearby streets in urgent need to get into a different atmosphere, to see other houses, other people. What could she do? To whom could she turn? To whom could she confide? With these constantly recurring thoughts, she hurried in a rush through the streets and squares, disregarding the bustle and jostling, disregarding the astonished looks of the passers-by. It had just turned noon. Random crowds of colorful and lively people surged from the shops. They arranged themselves into columns on the pavement, inserting themselves into the roaring traffic in the streets with unrestrained noise, high-spirited laughter, and chatter. These were mostly young people running away from the tightnesses of their offices and workplaces, exploiting their freedom and self-indulgences. Some shop girls laughed when they saw Mary struggling to make her way through the tangle of people. Young men prepared to make a way for her, while at the same time whispering lewd invitations to her. Mary did not hear any of them. From the height of her contemplation, she saw all this zealous activity of the people in the street, this rush as rampant folly that was pointless and foolish, as something that she didn't comprehend and didn't want to understand. What could she do now? Whom could she entrust with her misery? She considered all conceivable resources, considered every person that had been kind to her in her life, and she always returned to her husband as the only true support in her life. But how could she face Albert? How could he make the unthinkable and ungraspable become understandable and manageable? How could she bear witness as his heaven collapsed? And how could she overcome it by defiling herself and submitting in repulsive penance? No. To reveal herself to Albert would be to cause him an agonizing death and would impose a useless martyrdom on him. But Robert, a sudden fright struck her. Finally, she thought of Robert, and now she could only see him in a shadowy form, an indistinct, blurred outline. And she saw that she was moving farther and farther away from him, could barely see his shadow, and unsuccessfully reached out for him. "My love," it cried out in her, "my life, don't leave me." It seemed to Mary as if the earth was shaking under her feet. With all her strength, she quickly entered a small park through a side entrance, where she sat down on a bench with a trembling heart. She sat there for a long time, deeply grieved, contemplating, fearful, yet hoping to achieve something, anything. The sheer variety and severity of her troubles prevented any clear orientation and obscured her path forward. It was late in the afternoon when she had somewhat recovered from her condition. Then she thought of what she had said to Rosner yesterday, and thought that it might be a good idea to say a few soothing words to him in person. So she set off on her way. Otherwise, she had nothing to do with her time anyway. Her husband had conferences and would not be home until late that night. Mr. Rosner was an old schoolmate of Albert's. Even at a young age, the two had formed a close friendship, which they had developed more and more, and then deepened into their later working lives. That was when it became clear that Mr. Rosner was not suited for a commercial life. Over and over, his business attempts ended in failures, until he had almost completely lost his substantial fortune. When his situation became unsustainable, he turned to his childhood friend Albert, who miraculously managed to recover 10,000 gold crowns, which he had invested on the basis of some speculative calculations. Mr. Rosner had also done other equally poor business investments and had loaned Dr. Sharp a considerable amount, the remainder of his wealth, for some short-term and very profitable business. The money ran through the hands of Dr. Sharp within a few days. He kept putting Mr. Rosner off from one day to the next, with all kinds of evasions, speeches, and promises that were forgotten in the blink of an eye as soon as they left his mouth. After threats of criminal proceedings, he had come to Mr. Rosner today and declared the following: "Don't worry about your money. You will get it back under all circumstances. If our business should fail, Mrs. Mary Rayner, your friend's wife, will make it available to me without further ado." "For what reason and under what circumstances would my friend's wife give you money?" asked Mr. Rosner, who suspected another attempted abduction. "On the basis... But I only tell you this with the strictest discretion. On the basis of my relationship with Mary," replied Dr. Sharp. This explanation was a personal insult to Mr. Rosner. He jumped up from his seat and said in a menacing tone, "What kind of silliness is this? How are you ever going to prove such a monstrosity?" "Proof?" "Of course he had proof. If it was really needed, by the way, yes." A sharp pain reminded Dr. Sharp of his nasty infection, which he had been suffering for several days. He knew that the best way to stop a lawsuit by Mr. Rosner was to implicate his friends. So he continued, "Unfortunately, I also have visible evidence, because since I last hugged Mary, I have contracted a nasty disease. But I count upon your confidentiality, Mr. Rosner." He finished and left the house in a hurry. Mr. Rosner, who was now concerned about the fate of his old friend, could not and did not want to believe in Mary's guilt. She, whom he had never seen otherwise than naturally carefree, with a graceful amiability, and her integrity written plainly on her face, could not possibly act against her own nature. "Dr. Sharp," said Mr. Rosner to his wife, who had been listening to the earlier conversation, "is a windbag and a malicious slanderer." But this impression changed with a stroke when Mary's letter arrived soon after, in which she admitted the loss of the money. "Now you see that there is a deep relationship," Mrs. Rosner said to her husband. "So Mary is also a hypocrite. Just be happy to get your money back from Dr. Sharp any way you can." Mr. Rosner was so deeply shaken in his conviction that simply believing in Mary's innocence was not enough, and he decided to find out the truth for himself. Not long after that, Mary entered the house. She was received with an embarrassed grace. A small conversation of leaden sluggishness developed with difficulty. The mood was everywhere, and Mrs. Rosner made the situation even more intolerable through her deliberate constraint. Mary sensed that they had taken her news badly and wanted to clarify a few details, so she asked Mr. Rosner for a private interview. His wife then left haughtily without saying a word. "Now tell me, dear Mary," Mr. Rosner began warmly, "what is with that story about the money?" "I wrote you about it, Mr. Rosner," replied Mary in painful embarrassment. "Don't be afraid for it, I ask you." "I'm not concerned about it, Mary, but you are hiding something. Something that I don't dare think about, let alone believe. Dr. Sharp was here." "My God!" cried Mary, terrified. A pale pallor crossed her face, and she was only able to speak softly in syllables. "Did he betray me?" "So it is true," said Mr. Rosner in deep depression. "My poor unsuspecting friend. But listen to me, Mary," he continued, deep in thought. "I must leave it to you to arrange your own lifestyle as you choose. However, in the interests of my friend, I urge you to see a doctor because you have a terrible infection, which you know that Dr. Sharp also carries, and..." "You are insane," shouted Mary. "What are you talking about?" "And if you will do something else," concluded Mr. Rosner, "leave your husband's house voluntarily, and our house as well, which we do not want you to infect, added Mrs. Rosner, who, with her curiosity now satisfied, stepped back into the room. Mary, who seemed about to fall, gathered herself up with all her energy. Her face transfigured, and she shouted in an almost cheerful tone, "Yes, I will do both. I will leave both your house and that of my husband." She broke into a short, dissonant laugh and hurried out. "Robert, Robert." It was the cry of a desperate, uprooted woman whose last foundation had collapsed beneath her feet. With those words, Mary rushed into Robert's room. "Robert, we're leaving right now." "But my darling," replied Robert, "you are completely undone. Have you really decided?" "Yes, of course," said Mary. "Let's not waste any time." "Just calm down, my sweet dear girl. How divinely unapproachable you look, just like Juno. Come here and sit with me." "No, Robert, dear, dear Robert, let's go now," pleaded Mary beseechingly. "I bow to the will of the tyrant," said Robert with a comical gesture. He began to fill his travel bag with all sorts of little things, and in between continued in fragments. "But woe, when its brilliance breaks, his kingdom lies there in ruins. The slaves all rise, feel their value growing. Shake off all the dust and walk freely like gods." So this umbrella, too, and then you, Mary. Yes, then you, concluded Robert pathetically. All that I will need for a century. He wrapped his arm around Mary's waist and led her down the stairs. On the street, he called for a car and gave the driver directions. Just before the train left, they both slipped into the sleeper, and the train rolled into the deep night, through meadows and forests and mountains and valleys. It rolled over all the longing and raving of the heart, over all the rivers and seas of life. Meanwhile, Magda spent the most exciting hours of her life. Just yesterday, she had entrusted Dr. Sharp to follow Robert Langdorf's footsteps, observe his way of life, and discover his goals. She had an immense interest in getting to know the life and plans of Robert, and had been consumed with passionate longing for him for a long time, in secret, without saying a word of it to anyone. When Robert had approached her unsuspectingly yesterday, reminding her of her otherwise proven patronage of the arts, and asking for benevolence and support for his literary endeavors, she had been ready to pay him a considerable amount on the spot, but instinctively declined with the rash action on her part, just for show, with the prospect of having him come back again today. But he never came. And she knew nothing about him, did not know his plans. Dr. Sharp, who came to her drunk at night, had not said a word about him, and nothing had come from him today either, although Dr. Sharp should have been here long ago. Magda was so excited that she ran restlessly back and forth across the carpet countless times like a madwoman. Dr. Sharp. The entire world will never know how much she hated his name, how much hatred his name sparked in her. She not only hated him because he had not brought any news about Robert, but also because she could not get rid of him. She had drawn him to her many months ago and made him her lover. Today, he misused that fact for all kinds of blackmail. If only she could poison him in a most inspicuous way. Ah, if only she could get him out of her world. The doorbell rang, nervously, several times in a row. Soon Sharp rushed into the room and exclaimed in agitation, Magda, I am lost. God willing, Magda replied with deep contempt. What about Langdorf? I have not heard a word from you, although you were paid in advance. You are... Mary is gone. My plans are thwarted, whined Dr. Sharp. The devil take Mary and yourself as well, shrieked Magda. What about Langdorf, you paid lover boy? Ah, shameful woman, you long for a new plaything. You... Know this, my sweet bitch. Your newest idol, Langdorf, has left with Mary this evening. Are you sick, my darling? Are you having some of your hysterical heart cramps? Then that's fine with me. You disgust me. Have you fainted on me? I will make use of your fainting and hold myself innocent for your loss in the matter of Mary's flight. Dr. Sharp then went to the closet where Magda kept her jewelry and money. He found a bunch of keys, which he took. Just after he had unlocked and opened the little cash box, Magda recovered. Fleetingly, she thought about the intolerability of her situation in great detail, jumped up, gripped her revolver, and fired a few shots in a flash. Dr. Sharp sank to the ground with a short groan, several money notes clenched in his hand. Magda, after verifying that he was dead, hurried to the police and confessed that he had taken her by force and afterwards tried to rob her. At the same time, her own destiny was fulfilled. During her interrogation, she was recognized as an international fraudster who had been wanted for 2 years and was immediately taken into custody. Robert and Mary arrived early the next morning in a small seaside resort, where they rented a modest pension with 2 rooms. Neither of them could sleep. Robert was full of excitement, Mary with inner weariness. For the first time since he knew Mary, he was alone with her, alone, in a strange place, free from any chance of discovery, free from the annoying glares of idlers in the streets of the big city. Only here could Mary really belong to him, carefree, with none of the inhibitions from which she had never been able to free herself. It was late the next morning when he came into her room. Mary was lying in a semi-reclining position on an ottoman. In her pale face, around which short-cut blonde hair fluttered with every movement, there was a shy look in her eyes which shimmered with wetness. She was the picture of the most tender lovingness. Robert sat down next to her, kissed her hair, and tried to pull her close, but she resisted wearily. He tried again and again, speaking the most nonsensical tenderness to her, calling her little nicknames. But Mary was not to be shaken from her weariness. Hours of passionate pleading, supplication, and threats had passed for nothing. Then, when he tried to take her by force, she fought back fiercely and said, "This is unworthy of you, Robert." Then he was no longer able to contain himself and called out in great frustration, "You had a great night with your husband and are now sated." "Just as you say, Robert," replied Mary with tears in her eyes. "Whore," cried Robert in rage. But in the same moment he regretted his anger, prostrated himself before Mary, and covered her hands with pitiful kisses. "Forgive me, Mary. I'm out of my mind. Don't know what I'm talking about. I forgive you from the bottom of my heart, my dear Robert, but will not feel sorry for you," replied Mary with an unfamiliar firmness in her voice. "That vile word no longer sounds new to me. I called myself that the day before yesterday and countless times since then." "What are you talking about, Mary?" "I speak with the mature insight that has been given to me. Every married woman who has relationships with another man and has only a little ethical sensitivity will be a miserable wife, but an even worse lover. Never, Robert, will a woman of this kind ever be able to free herself from all her moral inhibitions, and she will always suffer from an inner split and division of her soul in which she finds herself in the arms of one and longs to be in the arms of the other. And because of that, she is a whore. And the higher her moral standards, the more painfully she feels her moral descent, the more intense her misery, and the more pronounced her prostitution." "I do not follow you, dear Mary," replied Robert with confusion. "You speak of love in a way as if it were the product of a well-thought-out, sensible matter that is subordinate to circumstances and can be regulated like clockwork. You speak like someone who does not realize that love is a natural event based on inner attraction, and which triggers spontaneous reactions in human beings, for which these bear as little moral responsibility as that of a hallway that has been devastated by a hurricane. Your words, dear Robert, prove to me that our basic opinions are by no means contradictory to each other. I certainly see love as an elementary force that does not recognize considerations and is carefree. But this approach is a general one and only works in theory. In practical life, however, we are subject to all the laws of society and, above all, to those of our own morality." "But we are agreed on the existence of natural law," said Robert excitedly. "So, I insist that the sublimation of natural law to practical considerations is a futile effort. You don't know, dear Robert, the power of real life. It is not much inferior to natural law. Sometimes it even surpasses it. Imagine, please, a married woman, such a woman as myself, stepping in front of her husband and saying, I am deceiving you for someone else. However, indulge me, because I act out of natural passions. This man would simply throw her out the door, while her lover would not accept her into his own home for many possible and applicable reasons. Consequently, if the woman is unfaithful to her husband without first asking for his consent, then she is constantly tormented by fear and repentance, always going from one man to the other and cheating on both. That, dear Robert, is how it is in practical life. And from this, I derived my knowledge that a married woman can never be the ideal lover of another, and that one must be resigned to it. Robert, who had listened eagerly to Mary, cried out in dismay, Mary, I have never heard you speak so matter-of-factly. I have never heard, I suspect. Tell me, Mary, don't you love me anymore? Mary thought of the last 2 days of her life, of all the humiliation and indignities, of all the abuse that she had suffered. She saw the image of Albert, who had always cared for her life with such infinite care, how he could no longer deal with this unexpected, sudden disappointment, and was increasingly collapsing. She bowed her head, as if she could not look at Robert, and said, If my constant conflict, my constant anxiety about Albert, my sense of guilt, my constant shame, my fear and regret, if all this, my dear Robert, is contrary to the concept of love, then no, I don't love you. Robert was staggered. He ran a hand over his forehead several times, as if it would help him to grasp what he couldn't understand about the meaning of her words. Mary, he called, and took her hands. My sweet little girl, it's not like it used to be. Tell me what happened, he asked. I can't believe the seriousness of your words. Mary replied sadly, What I just said I only felt vaguely after our first meeting. Then I guessed it the day before yesterday when I was forced to sacrifice myself, when a monster abused my mental and physical impotence to shame me publicly. It came to my mind even more clearly that unfortunate evening when I sat across from my unsuspecting husband and went through all kinds of torture and fear. And then the next day when I felt the poison of people like the sulfur smell of hell. To be clear, however, it came to me in that moment when you recognized me and called me a whore. Robert looked at Mary with burning hot eyes and all the agony of her words mixed with those in his own heart. So I came to know, continued Mary after a short pause, that there is only lack and endless need and a shadowy type of happiness, but not one of real value and positive content. There is no happiness that is worth the sacrificing of domestic peace, the personal integrity, and the honor of the husband. But what shall I do, Mary? My life without you is only a distorted half-life. I am nothing without you. You complement me and make me complete. My dear Robert, do not try to link your destiny to mine. From my previous life balance sheet, I draw the conclusion that all my desires constantly deceived me, that they swayed and fell, causing me much more agony than joy. Now this magnetic illusion has been destroyed, and I know that my striving and wanting was wrong, completely wrong. "What are you going to do?" asked Robert, filled with fearful anxiety. "I want," said Mary, "to try to get Albert's forgiveness, and no humiliation will be too much for me. If I cannot achieve this, then what is left is for me to die." "If you don't achieve your first goal, stay with me, Mary," cried Robert stormily. "No, Robert, I don't want to be the one who flees to her lover just because her husband throws her out." "Then just stay here with me now," stormed Robert passionately. "Because of all that has happened, I can never be anything more to you than just another whore." "So you really want to leave me, Mary?" Tears came to Robert's eyes. He knelt before Mary and hid his head in her lap. Mary kissed him. "But what will you do now, Robert?" Robert was sobbing and could not speak for some time. "I will go to Switzerland, where I will have better prospects for my work. With Magda's help, I could have gotten established from the start, but I refused it from an inner aversion." "You were right about that," said Mary. "Now go. I want to write Albert and leave on the next train. Just one last kiss. So, now go, my dear Robert." Robert had not quite closed the connecting door between their rooms when Albert entered Mary's room, stooping with tired, sluggish steps. Mary quickly gathered herself together, ran to him, and kissed his hand long and fervently. "Forgive me, Albert," she said softly with tears in her eyes. "My dear child," said Albert, only controlling himself with difficulty, "what have you done to me? But I know that you are not bad in your heart. You were just sick. Now come home. Nobody knows. Mrs. Rosner told me about your catastrophe last night. I immediately arranged your money liability, and Albert could no longer hold himself together. His knees trembled. The color of his face became more and more pale. Mary took him by the arm and led him to the ottoman, where he found it difficult to sit down. What I wanted to say," continued Albert, "this nasty illness of Dr. Sharp was not true. I found out from the doctors that there had been a deception. Incidentally, he was shot by Magda, and there was a letter addressed to you that the police found on him. That's how I found your address. How you must have suffered. My good Mary, now it is me who is terribly sick." Albert made a heroic effort to stand up, but Mary asked him to remain seated. "I brought you an overcoat, Mary. It's in the car downstairs. Come on." He stood up and with her help walked to the door. At that moment, she heard a small suppressed sob that came from the room next door. She released Albert's arm and wanted to hurry over. But at the same moment, Albert fell hard to the floor. He reached for his heart and said softly, barely audible, "An old sorrow, Mary, now ended." "Help, help," screamed Mary urgently, shaken with terror. Robert rushed in. The staff came, and a doctor was soon on the spot. He determined it was a heart attack. Albert was transferred to his hometown, where he was buried. For a long time, Mary could not get rid of the painful and horrible memories. Together with Robert, she turned his tomb into a flower grove. A year later, Robert and Mary moved to Switzerland. And that's the end of that story. See you next week.